Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
What's up, party people? You are dialed into Dialectics. This is Nikolai Brown. I'm your host. We got a pretty great show. We got a great show for you this week. We got Anamake with Unkwahanwe Rising as a guest this week. But before we get into that, just a couple updates about what's going on online. A bunch of new articles. We got a really good one on antiimperialism.com about the history of International Women's Day, what it kind of means today, and efforts by imperialists to try to co-opt that and how we can take that back in a revolutionary way. There's also a really good article about China and kind of understanding China today as an emerging imperialist power, and also discussing what it is, what socialism means. And that's an important topic because that's often misconstrued in any number of ways, whether it's saying Northern Korea is socialist today or whatnot, or, you know, any of these questions. There's also another article on antiimperialism.com about Australia's genocidal campaign against the people in the Pacific and the Middle East. Check that out. That's pretty interesting. And on revolutionary ecology, a little bit of U.S. news. Idaho just passed an ag gag law, and it really reveals the class nature of the state. There's a new article on that. Check that out at revolutionaryecology.com. So, to our guest, Anamate with Unkwahanwe Rising, and I know I did not say that right. I'm very sorry. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How's it going?
Pretty good. Yeah, it's a Namake. It's not too important, but...
Sorry about that. Say that one more time.
It's a Namake.
A Namake. All right. Yeah, and say the name of the website again, because that's the one I thought I butchered.
Sorry, yeah. It's Unkwahanwe Rising. It's a Ganyagahaga Mohawk word, so the spelling isn't quite phonetic to English speakers, but I'll give the URL to the website later.
Definitely. And of course, it's linked as well at antiimperialism.com, revolutionaryecology.com. So if you haven't already checked that out, people definitely should, because there's a lot of really cool news that's posted on that. And I guess that was going to be my first question to you. What is this web project about? What are you discussing? Why did you start it?
Well, I guess why I started it is the best place to start. I've been involved in anti-imperialist, anti-colonial activism for a long time, and I used to run a personal blog called The Speed of Dreams. But I wanted to, move that forward, that sort of project. I wanted something to be more collaborative, and to maybe, start seriously networking with people. So we actually have a team of people on Unkwahanwe Rising. There's a couple of other editors. We're trying to get a couple of contributors in, and we're trying to, cover a lot of, as much ground in North America as we can. One of our editors is from Oklahoma, so-called Southwest United States. We've got another one from the Prairies region in Canada. And then what we do, I think the byline on our website sums it up pretty well. It says an indigenous perspective on third worldism and revolution. And one of the things that we really want to do, and it's something we try and do a lot in our networking with groups in Canada and the United States, is that we believe that history of anti-colonial or national liberation movements in North America, when this whole idea of multinationalism, in which tends to be a code word for white land, so there's the strong history of trying to assimilate our movements for national liberation, whether Unkwahanwe, which is indigenous North Americans, or Chicanos or New Africans or something to co-opt our movements inside into these like kind of like white-led so-called communist movements. And we our line, our basic line is that the United States and Canada as settler colonial nations, these white working class people generally have a more material interest in the maintenance of the current colonial relationships, not just in North America, but around the world. And so they tend to derail our movements for national liberation. So we believe that to truly liberate ourselves, we have to not only look at for our real allies, you know, the answer to Mao's question, who are our friends and who are our enemies, to look at not only the other domestic colonies, but at the oppressed and exploited nations and peoples around the world, the peoples of Africa, the Caribbean, so-called Latin America, Asia, etc. And so that's what we do. That's our basic line. And you know, we cover a lot. We try and popularize struggles, indigenous struggles for land and against ecocide and against genocide and against cultural assimilation within the dominant settler colonial nations, empires, rather, in North America, the so-called United States and so-called Canada.
Well, that sounds like I agree with all of that, and that's a big mouthful, and we're going to try to get into a little bit of that. Now, I had Ward Churchill on a couple weeks ago, and I was, you know, I guess I'm never disappointed to speak with Ward Churchill, listen to Ward Churchill speak, but I was kind of disappointed that he took such an anti-communist stance. It was almost like he was, read a William Hearst newspaper in the morning and forgot to take his grain of salt or something like that, and Rudolph or Randolph Hearst was the newspaper. But in any case, Marxism isn't necessarily popular within indigenous movements, and I think, you know, it's kind of obvious why that you know, there's a fair degree of amount of chauvinism within the communist movement historically that has, whether in, actually existing socialist countries or within countries, you know, stellar colonial oppressor nations like the white nation, that have acted very chauvinist in a very chauvinist manner. But you take this position that Marxism is still nonetheless important. And why is that? Why do you see that fusion of Marxism and Native struggles as necessary in today's world?
Well, the most fundamental reason why is compared to, say, anarchism, which is probably the predominant radical anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist ideology or trend within the indigenous movement in North America, or compared to a lot of people are probably call themselves traditionalists. A lot of them tend towards cultural nationalism. We at Umbulihumli Rising, and I in particular, do not believe that anarchism or cultural nationalism are able to really kind of answer the sort of questions we need answers to in order to free ourselves. Most fundamentally is Mao's question of who are our friends and who are our enemies. I don't think that anarchism, with kind of like its fundamentally idealist, philosophically idealist way of analysis, is really capable of answering that question. And of course, cultural nationalism isn't either. A lot of indigenous people, we look to our traditions, for like kind of these non-capitalist ways of existing, non-patriarchal, etc. And I think, I tell people a lot that those views, our traditions, are capable of giving people, a really beautiful view of what we want to be, but it doesn't answer, how are we going to get there? We need to know who our friends and who our enemies are. We need to know how to organize, and I think, Marxism, particularly Marxism-Leninism, Marxism-Leninism-Maoism, really answers the question of, what sort of organization, what sort of tactics and strategies we need to really free ourselves, and it probably makes me somewhat unpopular within the indigenous movement, although I'm working to change that. You know, I accept the need for there to be a revolutionary state. You know, I don't think that anarchism, again, not that I'm trying to harp on anarchism necessarily, but I don't, you know, anarchism with its anti-statist perspective, I don't think really can answer, you know, how are we going to deal with the counter-revolution? After the, you know, how are we going to consolidate a revolutionary seizure of power? And so that's why I believe that Marxism is, you know, still fundamentally important for the liberation of oppressed and exploited peoples around the world, and for us as well.
Definitely. And I guess just to throw it out there, if for listeners, if people are interested in learning more about, like, that distinction between anarchism and communism, a good resource is Nikolai Bukharin's Anarchy and Scientific Communism. Nikolai Bukharin was a communist in the Soviet Union. You know, he was eventually, I guess, purged in one of the trials in the 30s, but nonetheless, it was a very good text during the period. I think it was written in, like, 1917. But he really details, like, the very substantial differences between anarchism and communism. So that would be a good resource for people who are kind of wondering more about that sort of question. And I guess that brings up a kind of – we're still early on in the show, but we might as well get into it. You know, I remember the first time we kind of encountered each other. It was actually we were debating each other on, I think, the Anarchist People of Color website in the comment section. And I remember kind of one of the things we agreed about is we both kind of liked Jay Sakai. And you know, I think we can both agree that Jay Sakai's Settlers, the Mythology of the White Proletariat, is a very important text. You know, when it was written in, 89, something like that?
I think 79 is when it first came out.
70, okay, yeah, 79. Okay, that makes more sense, actually. And even important today in terms of really understanding U.S. history in a sort of oppositional sense, the sort of oppositional history. But I guess I wanted to get your kind of perspective on that book and how it kind of informs your political views and what significance you see of it for it.
Yeah, Sakai actually kind of really changed my whole view. For a long time, I was actually involved in a lot of, you know, various kind of first worldist Marxism in Canada. And Sakai was always this really kind of much maligned text. It was always kind of like, you know, the Marxist boogeyman. I used to be a member of an organization that had this absolutely terrible review of Sakai, and I just kind of used to accept that garbage, but, you know, hook, line, and sinker. But when I actually read Sakai, you know, it really kind of opened my eyes. You know, I was independently coming to a lot of my own conclusions through my own experience on things like what some people call the white left, you know, the settler left, you know, or something like that. And Sakai, through his analysis of history, really help solidify, you know, my, you know, it kind of helped me see that, you know, I wasn't the only person who thought like this. And so it was really good for me, my own personal development. And we promote Sakai quite a bit on Ungwe Hunwe Rising. Yeah, it's a bit of a data text, and it does specifically deal with the United States rather than Canada or North America as a whole, but I think it's an incredibly powerful consciousness-raising text. It's often something I have a physical copy of it, and I also have a PDF of it, and it's a text I often give to people who are, you know, interested in learning about our line or about a, you know, kind of third worldist Marxism in general, or about about domestic colonialism in the United States. It's a text I give people because I think Sakai really lays it out in, you know, pretty clear terms, you know, about the nature of the United States and how it was built on, as one of my favorite punk bands put it, native graves and beaten slaves, you know, and really kind of just, you know, lays bare the nature of the United States of America.
Yeah, it certainly does, and it really exposes a lot of that progressive mythology around U.S. history. I mean, you get, what is it, Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States, which is well-researched and it's well-written. And I'm not going to say, like, Howard Zinn's a bad writer or a bad person or anything like that, but it's a horrible history text in terms of understanding, like, in terms of actually having a kind of radical understanding of U.S. history. Yeah, he does play a little lip service to, you know, capitalism is bad, but he really misses that point on who are our friends, who are our enemies, and he really has to cherry-pick history in order to do that. And you know, just to give one example, he spends all of, like, a paragraph or maybe three, four paragraphs at the most, talking about Japanese internment, for example, which, you know, that's a pretty significant part of history. Granted, it's not like, you know, the defining element of U.S. history, but nonetheless, to spend, three paragraphs in a so-called people's history is pretty ridiculous. And Jay Sakai kind of, you know, obviously the book was written before Howard Zinn wrote that, but he really kind of exposes that sort of short-sightedness on the part of the U.S. left. And, you know, you mentioned something, you said kind of the white left, and I don't mean to throw out a curveball to you, but I know there's going to be people out there that are like going to say, oh, well, wait a minute, not all white people are bad, yada, yada, yada. And I just wonder how you respond to that, you know, when if you say the term white left and somebody kind of pipes up and they say, oh, well, what about, you know, Barry over there who, well, I guess Barry's a bad example considering Obama, but, you know, so-and-so who's white and he's a good comrade, yada, yada, yada. What's your kind of take on this? What do you mean whenever you say the white left?
Well, when I say the white left, you know, I know you had Omali Yeshitela, the Uhuru movement, on a couple of weeks ago, and I think I really kind of agree with the Uhuru movement when I say white left. When I say white left and when people like Sakai say white left, we really kind of mean the nominal kind of left wing. They may say they're communists, and they say they're socialists, and they say they're revolutionaries, Marxists, etc. They may say they're about overthrowing the capitalist state, but fundamentally, white left of people who say they're communists, revolutionaries, but who programmatically and in their actions do not kind of radically question they don't question the United States of America or Canada as, you know, these settler colonial societies. They may pay lip service to national liberation for African people or Marusha, which are Puerto Ricans or Chicanos or, you know, Hawaiians. And they often, you'll see, I think what's often a really telltale sign of who's a white lefty. When people may pay lip service to all these other kind of organizations, things like that, they may support, you know, Republican New Africa sort of movement. There's only ever tends to be lip service, very vague lip service to indigenous national liberation. And I think that's because radically people who are part of the white left don't want to really question, you know, what does indigenous liberation mean? You know, what does it mean if we give the land back to Native people? Well, you know, it means that the United States and Canada cease to exist. And these people in their programs, they tend to want to create what I often call a USSA, you know, a United Socialist States of America. You know, that's kind of their vision. They don't question that, you know, we really rising believe that a fundamental prerequisite for revolution in North America is that kind of these settler colonial entities in some form or another have to cease to exist. You know, they can't be, Canada cannot continue to exist as Canada. The United States cannot continue to exist as the United States. We do not see, you know, the United Socialist States of America. And I think organizations that do that, those are who I would consider to be white left. And, you know, those are probably the more covert white left. They're the more overt white left. They're the people who don't even recognize, you know, national liberation or even racism. I think there's a subtle distinction between kind of racism and colonialism and what that real issue is there. You know, you get a lot of organizations who would say that, who would even reject that, like, you know, kind of a Ted Allen-esque, Howard Zinn-esque sort of idea that, you know, the, you know, racism divides the working class, you know. So anyone who would reject that, even, like, you know, kind of this idea of, you know, the working class, so-called working class in America is divided along lines of race, so those people are certainly part of the white left. It doesn't even necessarily have to do with, you know, people's so-called race or their national background. It really has to do with, you know, so you can have an African person or a Native person who is the white left, because it's really about what they're seeking to create and how they're seeking to go about doing it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's kind of one of the bigger misconceptions, like, by making this distinction, it's not like, you know, these people have to be put in re-education camps necessarily, although, you know, I mean, quite honestly, most people do need re-educated, even myself, you know, I mean, we all kind of suffer from, you know, backwards ideologies, kind of things that we've picked up, but nonetheless, I mean, it's not like we make the distinction so that we can properly orientate ourselves, so that we can work the white left in a reasonable manner that does actually advance revolution, that doesn't necessarily just obscure, you know, these very fundamental political differences. I know within the Canadian section of the settler colonial entity, that there's been a recent kind of upsurge in Native struggles around not only sovereignty issues, but things like environmentalism and things like that. And that's drawn in a lot of, you know, what's often termed white allies. And how do you think is the best way to kind of approach those sort of relationships as a Native revolutionary?
Well, my views are informed quite a bit by the fact that I was involved in the rural movement for a long time. I think when white people, so-called white people, settlers, when they come to us and to our organizations, I think, and they want to work with us or within what we're doing, our land reclamation camps or, you know, whatever network people may be organizing, I think settlers have to be willing and able to be accountable to the colonized, to take leadership from the colonized. And I think when white people organize their own organizations, I think it has a lot to do with, you know, their line, you know, whether they're defeatist towards their own state. But, yeah, we're particularly talking about white allies. Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the question of taking leadership and, you know, humbling themselves before the colonized and, you know, kind of forming the relationship like that, not thinking they can go in and, you know, because they're Mr. Big white academic Marxist or anarchist or, you know, such and such, or that they work for such and such communist party that, you know, automatically we should be taking leadership from them. I think, you know, of course, it has to be the other way around.
Yeah, definitely. Well, now I know a lot of the audience probably doesn't have a big idea of, like, what all these struggles are that are happening, but can you explain some of the things that are going on in what I like to call occupied America, this kind of portion of the Western Hemisphere that was essentially stolen at gunpoint and kind of, you know, the borders were thrown up and whatnot. But what's the sort of organizing that's happening today among indigenous people?
A lot of it is decentralized, and there's a lot of struggles that are going on. I can give you a bit of a snapshot. We could dedicate a whole show just to talking about each and every single, you know, struggle that's going on. But, for example, you know, looking at what's in Canada, there's an organization that we try and work with, you know, the Rising Cold Action or the Anishinaabeg Confederacy to invoke our nationhood, and they're involved in a lot of land reclamation struggles around Anishinaabeg, historic Anishinaabeg land. Anishinaabeg are people who probably best known as Ojibwa, or for American listeners, probably known as Chippewa. And they're organizing a lot in Ontario. As a lot of people in the U.S. are probably aware, because there was some very popularized struggles around it out in what they call Atlantic Canada, which is like New Brunswick, Nova Scotia-type area. The Mi'kmaq have been waging a pretty militant struggle around fracking, or so-called hydraulic fracturing, you know, to bring out, you know, fossil fuels from the ground. And actually, they part of the blockades they raised, they actually have people who are languishing in Canadian dungeons right now over that. And actually, some members of the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society and Action have just concluded a Canada-wide speaking tour to popularize the struggles, and they went out west, because, you know, there's a lot of struggles going on out west as well. I mean, that's Canada. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going around the tar sands. A lot of native communities live downriver from the tar sands, and the tar sands, it's killing the land, and the people who live on the land, predominantly who it's killing, are, you know, Unwaihunwai people, you know, and then in the United States, there's a lot of resistance to fossil fuel, ecocide type stuff in Canada as well. This whole Keystone XL pipeline, there's a lot of indigenous organized resistance to that going on in the Great Plains region of the U.S. One struggle that we've also done some work around popularizing at Unwaihunwai Rising is what's going on in White Clay. White Clay in the Plains is this small white town. It has little more than a dozen official residents, but, you know, a significantly high per capita number of liquor stores. And it exists just off of one of the principal Lakota reservations that have banned alcohol. And the reason they have banned alcohol is because alcohol has been used for so long by the settler empire as like kind of a type of a chemical warfare towards indigenous people. You know, it's kind of the prototype of what some people say the CIA did with crack cocaine in the ghettos and barrios in the city. And but White Clay exists just off of the border of the Lakota societies, and it sells alcohol to these people, and it actually supports illegal bootlegging on the res, etc. And there's been a lot of struggle around there, organized by the Lakota, specifically organized by something called the American Indian Movement Grassroots. They also have some allies in the Deep Roots United Front, which is kind of this pan-colonized direct action sort of organization. And they're working a lot to try and get to run the liquor stores out of White Clay, to get White Clay shut down. You know, so that's just a snapshot of a lot of the struggles that's going on. Like I said, we could dedicate an entire show just to talking about, you know, the struggles going on in, you know, a specific region of the continent.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of people don't conceptualize how widespread these struggles are. I mean, you know, people hear indigenous and they, you know, have this image of their head of a very small minority, but the reality is, you know, colonized indigenous people exist around all parts of the world, you know, from India to Latin America to the United States to, you know, the Pacific Islands. So these, and a lot of the struggles are the same. There's the struggles for land reclamation, to not have sacred lands destroyed by, you know, what's euphemistically called development. So these struggles have an importance in the modern world system in terms of opposing that sort of capitalist dynamic that's happening today, that's destroying the earth, you know, that's building massive, you know, toxic sites to extract oil out of sand and, you know, whatever else they can try to get it out of, you know. So these struggles are important, and I think that's missed a lot of times in Marxism, and as I explained earlier, within the white left. And I was wondering if you would kind of, share some of your opinions on kind of the overall significance of indigenous struggles, not just within North America, but globally for a world revolution.
Well, I think, you know, when looking at it with Marxism as a frame, right, I kind of, you know, one of our points at Unruly Rising a lot is we're not Luddites, but we do believe that there is a lot of kind of, you know, worship of industrial development, factory worship, what sometimes we and some other people have called a techno-utopianism. You know, this idea that, like, you know, that sort of progress is inherently good. And I think a lot of indigenous struggles, because they often are struggles against extractive industry, against this kind of euphemistically termed, you know, cause of development, I think there's something a lot of Marxists could learn from that in terms of how they view the relationship to the planet, to the wider kind of ecosystem. And so I think that's one kind of aspect of the importance of it. I think one other thing, you know, looking at how certain movements have carried on in North America, not just North America, sorry, but kind of the Americas in general, you know, so that's kind of where I tend to look at things. Another frame of development is not just kind of this industrial development, but kind of like civilizational development, for lack of a better term, right? You know, you get a lot of Marxists. You know, I'm not the sort of person who says that Marxism is inherently Eurocentric, but a lot of Marxists do kind of have these kind of colonizing, frankly, Eurocentric views. And so it actually, you know, for example, in Colombia, right, there's been a lot of conflicts in the past between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, and indigenous people in Colombia, and it's because the FARC often goes into these indigenous communities and simply declares traditional leadership to be, you know, primitive and backwards, and that they need to accept the FARC as leadership. There isn't really kind of a mass approach to it. It really is kind of this condescending colonizing view. And what it does is it drives indigenous people, it sometimes drives indigenous people into the arms of reactionary forces. It's a situation that the Colombian state, for example, has taken quite a bit of advantage of. And so I think maybe, you know, Marxists kind of need to rethink a lot of, like, how they view indigenous peoples in traditional society in terms of trying to come towards a more sort of mass approach to things.
Definitely. And that was, I mean, in a way, I think that was a little bit of the difference between Che Guevara's kind of focalist theory of revolution and Mao's People's War. In the sense that Mao really did focus a lot on winning over local populations, you know, during the Long March, there was example. I mean, there are these groups in what were considered the sovereign territory of China, which weren't, you know, under the, you know, weren't controlled by the Chinese emperor or nobody in China. They were more or less indigenous tribes within China, and, you know, Mao's passing through with his army, and how are these people supposed to know, you know, if Mao's a good guy, a bad guy, if he's a colonizer, if he's a, you know, a capitalist, if he's a, you know, any of these things. And so, you know, Mao has to pay special attention to the way these people are treated by the Red Army that's passing through. And one of the things he did was he gave them guns, you know, gave them weapons, you know, and in that sense, and didn't try to, like, have any sort of authority over them in doing so. It wasn't like this trade-off, like, okay, we're going to give you guns and, you know, you're going to fight for us now. It was just like, no, this is, you were going to give you guns, they'll just pass through. And what happened with Che Guevara in Bolivia is, you know, he didn't make those sort of contacts with the indigenous people. And it ended up being this situation where, you know, how do these people distinguish Che Guevara's band from any other, you know, drug smugglers or, you know, narco traffickers and whatnot. And so it's easy for them to give them up to the CIA or whoever is hunting them and whatnot. So it really what this sort of attitude does is it makes it so that the revolution doesn't succeed. That sort of chauvinist attitude, in my opinion at least. And that's kind of one of the significant aspects of it as well. It's, you know, you're not going to win a revolution by alienating oppressed people, more or less.
Yeah, I think, you know, another example is Che Guevara, of course, Nicaragua, where because of contradictions between the Mosquito people and the government of the Sandinistas, there was a situation that the CIA and the Contras were able to exploit, whereby some members of the Mosquito people, taking up the grievances they had with the FSLN, even though forces were trying to come to a negotiated settlement, that some forces of the Mosquito took up arms against the FSLN, and they were supported by the Contras and the CIA.
Yeah, certainly. So it's, you know, these sort of contradictions are very important for the revolutionary struggle. Yeah. So what sort of stuff are you hoping to have going on in the next year in terms of the web project and in terms of, like, the organizing? What sort of forecasts do you think we'll see for some of these indigenous struggles?
For some of these indigenous struggles? For Ubuntu Rising in general or, specific or for indigenous struggles?
I guess both. I mean, I imagine there's, you know, I mean, Ubuntu Way Rising is very much just connected in with and interested in these sort of struggles. So I imagine that it would reflect any sort of shift in the struggles themselves and vice versa, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I think my hope is that we'll continue to see an emergence of, more militant movements. In Canada, right, we had this whole what did they call it? Idle No More movement. And Idle No More, you know, mobilized people. But a lot of people, like our comrades at Action, said that we were never idle. You know, that's what a lot of people said. And so I think Idle No More has really died down. And in its place, we are starting to see the emergence of some of these more militant struggles. In the Action's land reclamation camp already existed before Idle No More, but since Idle No More, we've seen the Mi'kmaq resistance to fracking in New Brunswick. Just recently, this past week, last month, the Ganyagahaga Mohawk community at this town called Kandanaga in Ontario. Some forces there, warriors there, said that they were going to take action if the Canadian government did not launch a probe, an investigation into this epidemic of missing and murdered Ngwe'hunwe women in Canada. And, of course, the colonial government really couldn't give a crap about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so, you know, now we've actually got this situation going on in Tandanaga where they've actually followed through with their word and they have, you know, they've blocked the roads. And I just saw, might have been yesterday, might have been Saturday, that there's actually been, you know, some of the warriors from Tandanaga have actually been arrested. And so I think we are starting to see more of an upsurge in more kind of militant, less protesting, drumming in a drum circle in Ottawa or Washington, and more militancy. And I don't know if I can say it's a prediction, but it's always been my hope that we will start to see a lot more of that in the United States. Because, frankly, the Indigenous movement is a lot more militant, at least in my experience, in Canada. And I've often said I really want to see that kind of militancy sort of bleed down into the southern part of what occupied North America. And so, you know, in Ubuntu Rising, that's why we do so much work popularizing the struggles. And so I guess over the course of this coming year for us, you know, as these struggles arise, we're gonna really kind of dedicate our time to popularizing them, but also we really need to start providing like an analysis, right? Like it's great and all to report on the struggles at Tiendanaga or in so-called New Brunswick or in White Clay or wherever else, but we really need to start putting forward kind of this analysis about, you know, really examining materialistically our, you know, our current status in North America and where we need to go. So we've got articles coming up on, you know, why Marxism and not anarchism, for example. We also, a project I'm very interested in, and it's still kind of in utero right now, but there was a member of the original American Indian movement named Jimmy Durham, and he wrote this great essay in 1975-76, I think, about kind of bridging this indigenous traditionalism and Marxism-Leninism, and at the time it was Marxism-Leninism, and we really kind of want to work on sort of like updating his thesis, because we really do kind of want to bridge. We don't tell indigenous people that people that they have to give up their traditions to be Marxists, and I think that's one thing a lot of people. I think that's one of the reasons a lot of like this kind of anti-Marxism is popular. To kind of go back to something you said earlier, that they think they have to give up their traditions to be Marxists, and we really want to kind of work in the kind of like theory realm, the analysis realm of really kind of, you know, updating Jimmy Durham's thesis on bridging Marxism-Leninism, or today Marxism-Leninism-Maoism, and the radical indigenous traditionalism, to kind of, you know, also start to negate some of this kind of cultural nationalism that's in place quite a bit.
Yeah, and that's a good thing to raise. I mean, that was actually the next question I was going to bring up, and then we started going into all of this, and it's a good point to bring up that within the indigenous movement in North America, traditionalism generally refers to that the trend in the 60s and 70s that really rejected the U.S. imposed government councils, you know, the kind of the Fort Indian sort of government, you know, the hand-selected sort of officials that were oppressing the rest of the nation, essentially. So the traditionalists really rejected the moves of these kind of compradors and kind of stressed local autonomy, things like that. Is that a correct summation, or am I off base there?
Yeah, no, I would say that's pretty correct. Certainly the traditionalists, they definitely, I would say back in that period at least, because I would say the kind of what people would call traditionalism today is a little different. But historical traditionalism you saw a lot of the rejection of kind of these, middlemen, neo-colonial, comprador, sort of tribal governments, but also a lot of those movements. This is something that Jimmy Durham actually stresses in his writing. Is the traditionalists in a lot of ways were kind of like, you know, reconnaissance, even though they didn't say that they were, you know, Marxist or something, because they kind of wanted more of a communal sort of, so I guess you could say, I guess they were kind of like a primitive communist. And of course, I don't mean primitivism in like a kind of a bad sense, you know, but so that's why Durham really wanted. That's why when he's writing in 1975, right, he really does talk about what the traditionalism is, you know, and that's what we were just talking about, and why it needs to kind of be wedded with Marxism to really get where we need to get.
Hmm. Yeah, and we have about like 10 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you one more sort of theoretical question. And, you know, a lot of kind of, I guess within the left, that the kind of meme is that like all nationalism is reactionary or nationalism is bad, and that was kind of always been challenged within the Maoist tradition, kind of stating that nationalism of the oppressed is progressive, is applied internationalism was the phrase he used, but is essentially progressive. I guess we have about 15 minutes left. So I was kind of wondering, I guess, and I'm stemming from that, sorry, I just lost my train of thought. So you have the situation in which, you know, some nationalism is very progressive, but not all nationalism. And some of that cultural nationalism can actually be pretty, I don't want to say reactionary, but a huge distraction. And it really tends to take people's focus off of revolutionary struggles. I guess the thing that always kind of stands out to me is like going to a powwow, and then, you know, you see a lot of people with a lot of traditional elements, and then they'll have like an American flag and, you know, all of that sort of mess. Or, you know, honoring the their members that are in the U.S. military, for example. So there's this huge contradiction where you kind of have these sort of appearances of nationalism but not really the substance of it. But what's your take on the kind of distinction between cultural nationalism and, I guess, like political nationalism of the oppressed?
Well, I think, you know, specifically kind of within the Unway movement, how cultural nationalism tends to manifest, it certainly plays a distractionary role because, you know, a lot of what you get is kind of I don't know more, and I would say they were kind of strong kind of reformist, cultural nationalist elements kind of driving that forward that, you know, if we get together in a drum circle and we beat our drums and we sing our songs, that, you know, we do the right rituals, we do enough powwows or something that the colonial government's going to look at us and say, you know, oh, you know, we're really sorry we destroyed your culture there. Let us just bug off now and give you back your land. And, of course, that's obviously a lot of crap. You know, that's not how revolution's going to happen. And another thing cultural nationalism does is, within our movement, is it tends to kind of stress, you know, kind of personal spiritual development. Now, I'm not anti-spiritual necessarily within the movement, but, you know, kind of this like personal, you know, if I develop my own internal self, you know, that's revolution. And I think, you know, probably it is actually reactionary in some ways because it stresses kind of this individual development instead of, you know, collective liberation. And yeah, I think that is definitely, you know, that kind of needs to be defeated as a position within the movement. And but then in terms of the political nationalism, so obviously, you know, there needs to be kind of this political nationalism of the oppressed, but it is really kind of two strains of it. And there's kind of it hasn't really developed yet, but I think there is going to be a developing line struggle around it, around people who kind of stress the nationalism of individual indigenous cultural groups. So you have Mohawk nationalists, you have Lakota nationalists, you have Salish nationalists, you know, etc. Whereas, and then other people have argued, and have argued for some time, that we actually need to develop kind of like we call it like Unway nationalism. You know, back in the past, we were called it Indian nationalism, that we needed to, you know, understand that only by, you know, working together and not as these kind of geographically dispersed, you know, culturally and linguistically dispersed different groupings, you know, we're not going to get free by having, you know, Mohawk nationalism, you know, versus a bunch of other competing nationalisms. We, you know, there has to be kind of this indigenous revolutionary nationalism that is going to kind of knit us all together to work towards liberation.
Yeah, that's a very salient point. You had mentioned something just a second ago. What was it? Oh, shit. Totally spaced that. Well, in any case, it seems like that's definitely sort of a problem. I haven't ran across too many, like, you know, Mohawk nationalists, but it's definitely important to develop a sort of consciousness, a kind of pan-oppressed consciousness even, you know, and even in terms of Unway.
getting them to identify with, you know, the masses of oppressed people across the world, you know, who are typically in the third world or in the periphery, semi-peripheral, whatever you want to call it. And getting them to recognize that this struggle is larger than just, you know, the XL pipeline or you know, this land concession and whatnot. And it is a protracted global struggle, and I think the Web Project does a great job of that. Now, before I forget it, I want to have you spell that and give people some information about how they can get in contact with you or how they can get involved, what they can do to help. So go ahead.
Yeah. We don't have an email address for contacting us up, but people can drop a comment on the website. We can get back to people that way. But the URL for the website is onkwehunwezizing, which is onkwehunwezising. .wordpress.com, and I'll just repeat that maybe a little slower. It's it's onkwehunwezising.wordpress.com, and that's where you'll find us. And we have if listeners want to go there, we try and make a lot of resources available. We have a suggested reading list. We even have a small suggested viewing list of kind of videos to kind of help illustrate some of these different struggles that are going on. And so you'll be able to find a lot of resources beyond kind of just the articles on our website.
Cool. Well, and thankfully I just remembered what you had piqued my interest, and maybe we'll switch gears a little bit on the last little end section. You'd mentioned kind of in terms of cultural nationalism, a lot of times it being about like kind of personal enlightenment, personal spirituality, personal development, and whatnot. I found that to be a pretty big trend across occupied North America. And in fact, it almost seems like that's kind of, there's almost like this decentralized cult of self-help, so to speak. I mean, that seems to be the new sort of religion that Americans have gone for. It's like, you'll watch TV for 6 hours a day and then, spend 15 minutes trying to figure out, using some special contraption to make your life better. I guess that's kind of a stereotype, but people really kind of being obsessive about themselves and improving themselves, taking over as this kind of new sort of, I don't want to say religion, but a kind of cultural, definitely a cultural phenomenon within the United States, and I guess that reaches into the politics of the oppressed as well. Have you noticed anything in regards to that?
Oh yeah, well, I think it certainly does, and I think I wouldn't go so far as to say it's probably a concerted effort of the state, but I think it's definitely something that's out there, because like we were saying, it's not just within the indigenous movement, but if people become concerned, whether they're Africans or they're Lumwehunwe, even if they're settlers, if they're concerned with, their personal, enlightenment, spiritual development, whatever, then they're not, then it distracts from, that to stop kind of rampant ecological destruction or capitalist exploitation of, the third world. That we need kind of, collective movement and collective struggle and collective liberation. And you can't do that when you're, concerned about your own individual enlightenment.
And certainly, and it kind of has like this kind of almost devilish implication where it's like if you're somebody who buys into this sort of self-help ideology, they look at somebody who is oppressed, and instead of saying, oh, they're my God, they're oppressed, they say, oh, my God, that person hasn't focused on themselves enough. They just, haven't taken that time and energy to really improve themselves. So it really ends up being this kind of racist ideology in the end, where it's like, third world people just need to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, or poor people just need to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And how long have we been hearing that? So it's kind of the same recycled line, just
repackaged into, you know, you too can, you know, be successful and work and happy and all this, you know, garbage. What else, anything else you want to cover while we have you on the line?
Nothing that comes off the top of my head. If listeners are interested, I can give maybe the names of some books. If people are kind of interested in learning more about where we come from and our perspective, maybe, if you think listeners would like that. Yeah.
All right, go for it.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, we talked about it earlier, James Tye Stettler's The Mythology of the White Proletariat. That's an absolute must-read, not just for understanding Hunwei struggles, but, like we said, the nature of the United States in general. Looking more towards Canada, because, you and I spoke about it slightly a little bit before the show, that there isn't really kind of a settlers for Canada, but there is some useful material to understand kind of the settler colonial nature of Canada, and one in particular is the books by Howard Adams, and Howard Adams was this great kind of Métis Marxist and revolutionary nationalist. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he has this classic book that came out in around the same time as Settlers, actually, called Prison of Grass, Canada from a Native Point of View. And then there's some other good ones. Ward Churchill. A lot of Ward Churchill's books are great for these purposes. In particular, Struggle for the Land, Native American, Resistance to Genocide, Ecocide, and Colonialism, which I think is on its second edition. I don't think it's a third edition. It's kind of a great catalog of a lot of the struggles, you know, going on right now in North America. And one thing that Churchill does that I think is pretty good is he doesn't limit himself to just the United States. He also looks at Canada quite a bit. Probably one of the most important pieces, and it's actually just a short essay, and we have it on the website under our resources for study tab, is the essay I mentioned earlier by Jimmy Durham about bridging kind of a radical traditionalism with Marxism. It's called American Indian Culture, Traditionalism and Spiritualism in the Revolutionary Struggle. And that is very important. I think that's a very important one to read. To understand kind of how the specific oppression of indigenous women, I also would highly recommend Andrea Smith's book, Conquest, Sexual Violence and American Indian Genocide. Those four books, I think if you want to get a basic perspective, you know, understand, this is what Hunwei Rising thinks, more or less. Those books are the absolute must-reads.
Cool. And out of curiosity, what's your favorite kind of more Marxist-oriented texts or Maoist-oriented texts or whatnot?
My favorite one?
Your favorite view.
I actually really, really enjoyed Zach Cope's recent book, Divided World, Divided Class, because I think, Cope really, what Sakai did for America, Cope does for the world, basically. And I think in terms of definitely a contemporary revolutionary Marxist text, Cope's a must-read. And then in terms of, the classics, the big floating heads in the sky, I really do enjoy Mao's four or five essays on philosophy, particularly on contradiction and what's the other one? I'm going to totally blank on his name. On practice. Yeah, and I think, Mao's essays are really, I think, great at developing kind of the Marxist method for analysis. And I would definitely think that anybody who calls himself, a revolutionary really has to read Mao's work.
Yeah, and I don't think you understand that Mao is very accessible. Like, compared to Lenin or Marx, Mao is very easy to read. So I'm assuming that, it's in terms of political education, it's probably a bit easier to introduce a little bit with Mao. But anyways, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks, everybody out there, for joining us. Next week, we should have the show hosted by Zach Brown, not me. but I'll be back. Have a great one, everybody. Peace.